Yeah.
I left mine at the office.
Since I allowed several people to hand it in after the break, you can hand it in until then at some point.
Well, I don't want anything to do with the signing.
I know. I just.
I'm done.
Just take it.
I think it is possible that the index might be off.
It depends where you start your indexing,
yeah.
though. Because it actually does hold if you start your indexing at zero.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I did the Fibonacci one. I think.
If you just like thought it.
So where I was careless, I copied that problem from a book and I didn't realize that had used a different index. Well, it's typically the question, do you start at zero or at one for the numbers? Right.
This is actually...
I thought that was yours.
No. Bill.
That's Bill the turkey.
Oh, I thought that the turkey has a bill or very, very, very artistic.
He's got two eyes on the side of his head.
These are special turkeys. It's like which always lie on the ground. You have this with some fish where the eye migrates over to the other side because they lie flat on the ground with a flounder or so. And you probably have the same with turkeys, which. All sit to the bar.
Really understand this artist.
That way, they turn them on this other side when they're about to.
Yeah. So they don't see it. Yes. Yeah. That's exactly. You don't need to put with the other ones. You need to put a bag over their head,
right,
and
yeah.
they. But you walk them to the.
The eyes are always on the sides of the face.
Okay. Great. Are there questions? No? No. I'm teaching 602, which is not 602, 502, which is a follow-up on this class. So basically, the way I decided to split between 501 and 502 is that I moved that 501 is in some way more enumerating things and 502 is more structural things, certain combinatorial structures, codes, designs, graphs. Also, I moved all the things which require abstract algebra into 502 because some new graduate students might not have seen much of abstract algebra before, and this way there isn't any dependency thing or that it would come here before they have seen it in 566. So that's the reason for splitting.
Isn't 566 only a prereq for 601?
Yes, it's not formally a prerequisite, but it is. I mean, in some way you should have seen it as an undergraduate.
Okay.
And with the graduate courses, the prerequisites are a little bit more wishy-washy that we write something there just to fill out the form. So it's just in some way so no one is scared that it suddenly comes immediately. So that was the reason for splitting it up. Yes, I would be very happy to see you in 502. Yeah. And there it will be, if someone asked... I don't think there will be anything significant from 501 which 502 uses as a prerequisite. Beyond, yes, probably binomial coefficients or something really, really elementary. Okay. Yes?
Okay, so I was just wondering how helpful the most recent homework will be for the qual, because if we have all the points, like, I think it'd be really wonderful if we could just start studying for that instead of working on that. Like the one that we just got.
I mean, there are some things.
So funny, isn't it?
There are some things where the class started on, which could be on the final. And I mean, if you look at the take-home final, there is something related to symmetric functions. And I think that's also just, we didn't have this in the previous homeworks.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be on there. RSK, which will come after the break, the basic idea could come up. So, I mean, it is, I would at least look at the, actually I should look at the problems before I make vague generalizing statements. And problem, the first one, I mean, it's not that you have to do it, so I would say 66, 67 probably are not relevant. 65 could be, 64, not to work out the details, but if you look at 64 and you say, I have no idea how I would prove this, then you will probably have in general trouble with the final, because this is a basic thing, but the working out the details is not relevant for the final. It's just there for completeness. And 68, I think you should do once we've done it. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Is it up on your website yet?
Yes.
The homework 11?
I thought it is there.
No.
I'm not.
I checked earlier today. It didn't appear to be posted.
Oh, I forgot the push thing. Yeah. This is, it is on the version on my computer, and I need to click a button which says put it all. But I thought I had done that. Anyhow, it's intended to be there, and I don't know why it isn't there. And obviously, something went wrong between chair and keyboard. Other questions? No? So, since we spent last time successfully not making much progress in the material, so my understanding is that the lemma where I had which was used for the hook formula, where I had thought this is just a bit messy to do and I will have the substitute teacher do it, that plan fired back. So
what's the hook formula?
It's the thing that was supposed to be proven but was neglected to be proven.
So
we all proved it modulo 11, that is just annoying polynomial.
Yeah.
We all accept it as fact.
You, okay, yeah, I mean that is basically my question. If you're willing to, this is a lemma and the description is relatively short, probably because I taught commutative. It's a lemma about polynomials and it's a standard argument for working with multivariate polynomials. Basically the argument is to say, first you look at the degrees of the terms in the polynomial. You notice that the total degree of every term must be the same. So if you have xy square, you also could have x square y or x cubed, but you couldn't have x times y to the 5. Okay, and what you then do is, and that is in some way one of the reasons why we have abstract algebra, to deal with multiple variables is a mess. You would like to have just one variable. Can you do this? Can you assume that all variables but one are constants? Well, yes. What you do is you say you take all variables but one, take that polynomial ring, take its fraction field, then you have a field and you take the polynomial ring over that field in the remaining variable. And then you have a univariate polynomial. And that's what the argument does. It looks at it as a univariate polynomial and it does some substitutions. And it observes that if two of the variables have the same value, I get value 0. And then you use the fact that if a univariate polynomial has a root lambda, then x minus lambda has to divide this polynomial. And you do this for all the pairs, always going back to the univariate case, and thereby you see that the discriminant has to divide it. And if you go through the total with the total degree business, this takes care of almost all of it. Just this extra variable y needs to be dealt with, and that's what it then does with, again, by substituting a value. So that's very roughly what the argument does. It's not, nothing of the technique is needed for the course or for the final, and the proof is really just there for completion. If you're happy with taking this as a fact about polynomials, I'm not insisting to go through the proof, but I think I have the moral obligation to at least offer you a proof if you want to. Okay. What I would then suggest, since this is, look at it once more, and if you want to see a proof, if it's only one of you, I might say come by my office sometime and I'll show you, I'll explain you the proof. If it's several of you who want to see it, I'm happy to do it through in class. Okay, but you did the hook formula. I mean, I basically did before I left. I gave you this formula. It's for the number of tableaus of a particular shape. Okay. So then, Dr. Wilson did symmetric functions. These are polynomials, invariant, multivariate polynomials, invariant under any permutations of the variable indices. And you might have seen one class of these polynomials before, namely the elementary symmetric ones. And you might even have seen, though we didn't do this in this class, a theorem which says, the fundamental theorem of elementary symmetric functions, which says, you can write every symmetric function in terms as a polynomial in the elementary symmetric polynomials. That's the standard commutative algebra argument. What we are doing here is we're actually going a little bit broader. We are looking not just at the elementary symmetric polynomials, but we are looking at some other sets of polynomials and will show that they always span the space of symmetric polynomials. Two remarks. First one, I said sometimes functions and sometimes polynomials. Basically, I mean the same. Second remark, I'm sometimes a bit sloppy in saying what are all the indices of the variables? How many variables do we have? Essentially, these arguments are supposed to be for an arbitrary countable number of variables. They would even work for infinitely many variables. And it's just often in examples more convenient to just look at a finite number of variables. But yes, and of course, if it holds for infinitely many, it holds for finitely many by just substituting zero in the variables you don't want. Okay, so what are the bases we have? We have the monomial symmetric functions. So we have M lambda. This is the sum over all compositions alpha, x to the alpha, and that is a shorthand notation for x1 to the alpha 1 times x2 to the alpha 2 and so forth, where alpha are just compositions of n which as a partition are the same as lambda. So I allow to permute the positions. I don't just have 3, 2, 1, but also 1, 3, 2, or 2, 1, 3, and so forth as a partition of 6. And that the monomial symmetric functions form a basis, I think, is pretty obvious. Or do we? No, I don't think there we need to prove anything. Right? Because if a polynomial is symmetric and one term, x to the alpha, occurs in that polynomial, clearly all the other permuted terms need to occur. That's what symmetric means. So clearly they form a basis. That we get for free. The three other ones, we need to show something. So we have the elementary symmetric functions E lambda. That is the sum. So how do we define these? We define E lambda as E, well, what is lambda? Lambda shall be N1, N2, and so forth. En1 times En2 times and so forth times Enk. And we have that Em is the sum over all products of M indeterminate. So this would be X1 times X2 up to Xm plus X. And now all possible permutations, m different variables. So E1 would be x1 plus x2 plus and so forth. E2 would be x1 times x2 plus x1, x3 plus x2, x3, and so forth. Okay? So that's the elementary symmetric functions. Then we have the homogeneous and the power sums, and I'll repeat the definitions of them once it's their turn. And what you did is you showed that these were a basis that we got for free. You showed that these are a basis by looking how the E lambda are expressed in terms of the M lambda, basically looking at a base change matrix. Then had a theorem which said the coefficients in this base change matrix have a certain combinatorial interpretation. And finally, using this combinatorial interpretation, you showed that maybe by changing the indexing and making the indexing in rows and columns different, you can bring this matrix into a nice form where you can see that this matrix has an inverse. And once the matrix has an inverse, that tells you, that means you also can express the M lambda in terms of the E lambda, and therefore the E lambda also form a basis. That was basically the steps you did on Monday and last week Wednesday, right? Roughly in agreement that what happened. Okay, so basically what we are doing next is a similar idea but for different bases. And we are doing this for the complete homogeneous symmetric functions. Well, actually, a lot of this will be in one of the homework problems, but it's the same idea. And then we want to deal with we will observe that between the elementary symmetric functions and the completely homogeneous ones, there exists some kind of duality, and we finally will use a different, and that goes a little bit back into generating function territory, and then finally we will do also with a generating function type proof, show that the power sum symmetric functions form a basis. But this idea of having different bases, and these different bases, the coefficients in changing these bases having a nice interpretation, that's basically beyond the curiosity, oh, they are symmetric, isn't that beautiful? Beyond that, that is the reason why symmetric functions are interesting in combinatorics. For example, there is one basis which I will just essentially mention that it exists, which are the Schur symmetric functions. They are defined a little bit messy. And if you do the base change
between the power sum symmetric functions and the Schur symmetric functions, the coefficients are what is called the character table of the symmetric group. And some of you might know what, if you don't know what a character table is, don't worry about it. It's some group theory, some information about possible homomorphisms from the symmetric group. So this is inherently a very important algebraic and combinatorial object. And it comes from symmetric functions. So that's a bit the reason why these are objects which merit study. Anyhow, so let's look at the complete homogeneous symmetric functions. So we say HM, we want to do a somewhat similar definition here, but we allow two duplicate variables. So HM is the sum over all products of M possibly duplicate variables. So we have, for example, H3 would be X1, X2, X3 plus X1 squared, X2 plus X1 squared, X3 plus X1 cubed, well, and so forth, right? Or X1, X2 squared, well, you can get these combinations, and we say, so there we have that HM, therefore, is the sum over all partitions lambda, where lambda is a partition of M over M lambda, right? And we define H lambda simply as the product of H n1, H n2, and so forth up to H nk. Right. So now let's look at, here we have an expression of Hm in terms of the m lambda, but let's look at the coefficients of H when expressing H lambda. So this is lemma 528. Let n lambda mu be the coefficient of x to the mu in H lambda, so we have that given or given by the following. H lambda is the sum over mu partitions of n, n lambda mu, n mu. Okay. Yeah. Clearly, such coefficients have to exist because the m mu form a basis, and these are symmetric. So I need to be able to express them. Well, then n lambda mu is the number of n, or I should say n including 0 to be explicit. So I want matrices with non-negative integer entries, matrices A, which are Aij, such that if I take the row sums of A, they are lambda, and the column sums of A are mu. So that is a theorem which is quite similar to the theorem proven for
The base change between elementary symmetric and monomial symmetric functions, just there they were 0-1 matrices. And now we don't have 0-1, but we allow arbitrary non-negative integers. And the proof in some way isn't really that different. It just comes from the fact that we have not just 0 and 1, but we have larger numbers because we can have larger exponents. And that proof is will be in the exercises. Well, it's already on this new exercise sheet. In particular, if I have matrices, if I look at the matrices which have row sum lambda and column sum mu, if I transpose these matrices, they will have row sum mu and column sum lambda, and vice versa. That means these coefficients have to be symmetric. That's so corollary n lambda mu equal n mu lambda. And that's the same argument as before. Why is this of interest? For example, and that will be homework problem 66, what one can do is one can define an inner product on the space of symmetric functions. And in homework problem 66, it is defined in a slightly goofy way. Namely, we define not inner products of basis elements with respect to the same basis, but with respect to two different bases. And with a different basis, and then one can see that the symmetry will make that inner product, will allow us to show that this inner product really is symmetric. And well, therefore is a scalar product. Well, for showing that the H lambda form a basis. Now, what we could do, we could try to use the same kind of argument as done for the elementary symmetric function to now say, well, if we now look at this matrix n lambda mu, let's arrange the coefficients in a certain way and see that the matrix is upper triangular and therefore can be inverted. What I will do instead is to give a different proof because that shows some other technique. So, that's definition 529. Define a map omega, which goes from lambda, was the space of symmetric functions, to the space of symmetric functions, which is defined by mapping En to Hn and mapping E lambda to H lambda, and then extend it linearly. Because the E lambda form a basis, this is defined on the whole space. So I'm giving a map on a basis, extending it linearly, that is defines the a linear map in a unique way. So omega is a linear map. One could, again, if we were in commutative algebra, we would probably now show that the EIs actually are algebraic. If I don't look at E lambda, but just at these EIs, they are algebraically independent. And then the first part of the definition actually shows that omega even is an algebra endomorphism, but we don't need it. But for those of you who had commutative, I guess just the one of you who had commutative, no, you must also have had commutative algebra. No, you didn't have? Oh, okay. Anyhow, so it's even an algebra endomorphism, but we don't need this. Okay.
So the interesting thing about this is this endomorphism is what is an involution. It's an element which I apply twice is the identity. Omega square is the identity. So in particular, what does this mean? I can then tell what omega has to do on Hn and H lambda. Omega of Hn is En. Omega of H lambda is E lambda. But if I now have a linear map, now with this property, because it is the square is the identity, it's an invertible linear map. Well, it's actually its own inverse. That means the images of a basis have to be a basis. Right? So what we get for free as a corollary, the H lambda form a basis. Okay. Right. So, let's prove this. And what I'm going to do is I play again this algebra trick of saying, yes, there are some variables, but I just put them in the base field. So, what I'm going to do is I work in a ring where my coefficients are lambda. And now I'm taking formal power series in a variable t, where the coefficients of these power series are symmetric functions. That looks somehow a bit scary what these objects are, but if I just call them En or Hn, there is basically nothing to worry about. So, doing this, I consider, because that was a tool we used before, I consider generating functions. Generating functions in this variable. And there is nothing in the tool set of generating functions which forbids the coefficients to be more complicated objects. We can do the same kind of thing there. So here they are symmetric functions. So we define big E of t, E the sum over n greater or equal than 0, En t to the n, and we define H of t, E the sum over n greater or equal than 0, Hn t to the n. Okay, and now I claim I can write these in another form. I can write this as the product over R goes from 1 to, well, basically the number of variables involved. So if I have infinitely many, I need to take a limit process, but let's for the moment assume we just have finitely many. R1 plus XR times T. Okay, why does this hold? Well, just expand this. If you expand this, what do you get? Well, you get 1 as the product of all of the 1s, right? And indeed, there is an E0 which is 1, the constant 1. That's the only symmetric, up to scalar, the only symmetric function of degree 0. Okay. Now, in degree 1, you'd have one of the x's and otherwise the 1's. That gives you x1 plus x2 plus x3. If you have two of these factors, you get x1, x2, or x1, x5, or x7, x15, product of two of them, and so forth. So just by expanding this, you clearly get, if you expand this, you get as coefficient of t to the n, en. Okay. I want to do something similar for the Hn, and what I claim the product I have there is the product R goes from 1 to n
over 1 minus XRT inverse. Okay. Why does this hold? Well, let's expand this geometric function, your geometric series, right? The geometric series tells us 1 over 1 minus XRT, if t is our variable, is simply 1 plus XRT plus XR, XR squared, t squared, and so forth. And now, if I multiply these out, I have the same effect, but I could have any of the summons here in a product. So I will not just get all different variables, but I could get powers of individual variables. So again, by multiplying this out, we see this is the same here. So, okay. So we have these two product expressions. And now I claim with these product expressions, if I take h of t times e of minus t, what is this? Well, let's take these two product forms here. Right? If I take e of minus t, I don't have plus xrt here, but I have minus xrt here. And here I have 1 minus xrt, but I have the inverse. Then both of these terms just cancel out against each other nicely, and therefore this is 1. Okay. So this product is 1. What does this mean? Let's look at the product. Well, 1 is 1 plus 0 times t plus 0 times t squared, and so forth. Let's look at the term for t to the n. For t to the n, what is this? This is 0, because there is nothing with t there. That is 0 has to be equal to the sum I goes from 0 to n minus 1 to the I. Why minus 1 to the I? Because I have this minus t here. Ei times h n minus I. And that's just the formula for the product of two polynomials. Okay. Now let's apply omega. Omega is a linear map. And it also behaves, am I using here that it is an algebra homomorphism because I apply it to a product? I'm using that it is an algebra homomorphism. So once we apply omega, what will happen? Well, omega applied to 0 is 0. Sum behaves nicely. I goes from 0 to n. Minus 1 is just the scalar, so the scalar stays there. Omega of ei is hi. That's how we defined omega. And omega of hn minus I, well, is omega of hn minus I. And now I just re-index because I wanted omega of I there. Well, that's the sum I goes from 0 to n minus 1 to the I. There might be a global minus sign where I'm slightly sloppy here. But minus 0 is 0, so I don't need to worry about it. So I can replace minus 1 to the n minus I with minus 1 to the I, regardless what n is. H of n minus I omega of H I. Okay. So now I'm looking at this system. And I'm looking at this as a system of equations with the omega of hi as variables. Okay. So, this system is homogeneous, it has certainly a solution. We actually know one solution. We know this one, right? So, the ei are a solution to this system of equations where omega of hi are the variables. So, the only thing I want to do is I need to see this is a system of full rank. How can I see this? Well, specialize all variables but one to be one. So, what will happen there is, if I look at, so we had the H, let me write down once more about how the H's were defined. So HM was the product of, was the sum over X1, X2, up to xm, but I allow duplicates. And what I now want to do, I want to substitute, I want to do something. I don't want to set all but one to be one. I want all but one to be zero and the one to be one. Right? So, if I do this, if I set all variables but one to be zero, then the only thing which remains is that variable xi to the m. And if I set that variable to 1, then the HM specializes to 1. Okay. And if you now look at this, at these coefficients in the system, well, the minus 1 doesn't need to bother us. What are the, how does the matrix for this system of equations look like? Well, we have this times what are our here we have omega of H1, omega of H2, and so forth. Where do we have omega? Okay, what is our first equation? The first equation is omega of is H n minus 1 or n actually hn times omega of h0. I have this as well. I have hn minus 1 up to hn minus 1 up to I have this for arbitrary. I get equations for different n, so sorry. What is my first equation? My first equation is the equation for n equals 0, right? If I have the equation for n equals 0, I just get I get one term there, I get h0 times omega of 0.
So I have H0 here, and I have zeros all there. Right? Next equation is for n equals 1. There I get H1 times omega of H0 and H0 times omega of H1. And the rest are zeros. And next I get here H2, H1, H0, and zeros. Okay. And what I only need to do is I need to show if H0, if I can make H0 to be something invertible, I'm done. Or something non-zero, I'm done. And actually, I don't even need to specialize, right? What is H0? H0 is 1. So I don't even need to specialize. H0. So this is a matrix with ones on the diagonal, lower triangular matrix with ones on the diagonal that is clearly invertible. So that system is a system of full rank. We know already one solution, therefore that must be the unique solution. That implies the values for the variables have to be EI. And that's exactly what we wanted to show. And if we know that it holds for the EI, it automatically holds, or for the HI, it automatically holds for the H lambda. Okay. Yeah, so that shows this proposition and therefore implicitly shows that the HN also form, or the H lambda also form a basis, or the HN form an algebra basis. Okay. Right, so what is left is the power sum functions. And what I'm going to do there is to do the same idea of generating functions. So what I will do is I will define a generating function Pt, which would be the sum over n greater or equal than 1, pn, and the only thing I'm doing different is I'm taking t to the n minus 1. I'm doing a slight index shift. And what we will then see next time is that if we take the derivative of this generating function with respect to t, the formal derivative as we had defined it, the derivative of this is actually p of t times h of t. And from that we will be able to obtain an equation which allows us to express the h i's in terms of the pi's, and because the hi's are a basis, therefore also the pi's are a basis. They generate. Yeah, and that will prove the whole theorem about the different bases of the symmetric functions. Anyhow, that's something which I can't squeeze into 1 minute or so. So thank you very much. Have a good Thanksgiving break, and I'll see you afterwards. Thanks.